So I guess you know David Pegg. A lot of people here will know David Pegg. He was my supervisor some time ago. And working with David, you sort of, some of his ideas and things rub off. Can you hear me? Is that loud enough? And so he's got this personality of brooding over the nature of time, something that's been doing for a long time. And some of that has rubbed off. And just in the last couple of years, I've been thinking about these ideas. In fact, it was to do with giving a course, a few lectures on time in a course on life, the universe, and everything, one of those really general kind of courses. And that really got me thinking. So I should acknowledge talking to David and also Steve Barnett, but I'm not sure if they entirely agree with their names being put on this talk, because it's rather controversial. So what I want to talk about is this idea that we have a perception of time that's not really accounted for in physical theories. The reason, what I need to do to begin with is sort of justify this approach, because it's unconventional to talk about the flow of time and things like that. So the block universe had its origins with William James some time ago. The idea is that you have the past and the future, but the future is completely fixed. It's fixed as the past. We have a present. Well, that's fine. But with special relativity, with no simultaneity is relative, so there's no absolute present. So if you don't have an absolute present, how can you talk about the flow of time? And something that was pointed out by Hugh Price in his book recently is that if you've got a framework for physical theory, it should be free of anthropocentric ideas. I mean, the physical theory should be about the world in the absence of humans. And I think that's a pretty important thing. But what I'm actually talking about is an anthropocentric idea. Okay, so I'm not saying that physics should be anthropocentric. It's just that physics should be a framework. It should have a physical framework which is free of anthropocentrism. But it should also give an explanation of our perception of what the world is. That should be part of it. Okay, and the present in time is like here in space. And they don't have any special relevance in physics. They have relevance to us. I'm here, I'm not somewhere else. It's pretty relevant to me, but not in physics in general. So they're very subjective. But if you look at our approaches to different areas of physics, for example, the Everett's many worlds interpretation, which is a more holistic kind of view of the, well, it's a framework based upon Schrodinger's equation. But what we tend to do is say, well, actually, I only experience one, and we pick out one world. Okay, and that's very anthropocentric. And it's interesting that the many worlds theory actually predicts that you'll have this illusion that there's just one. Okay, so it predicts this illusion. The framework is so strong that it predicts that humans will have this illusion of a single universe. But that's not true for the present time. Our idea that time, where there's a present time, is not predicted by the theory, by any physical theory. So that's what I'm looking at. Can we draw out from physics this idea that there is a special time, a present? Well, it's more than just a present. It's the idea that we're kind of moving through, because there's a sequence of present times. So that's what I'm really interested in. So now, to be really kind of provocative, so if you look at Bohmian mechanics, that's really has its origins in thinking of physics as being a single quantum world out of the many worlds view of Everett. Okay, so it's trying to put in this idea, no, there's only one world, and how do I describe well, realism as well. How do I describe realism in this world? So that's anthropocentric. Now, I don't want to meet people at the back of the building after this talk, because I think Bohmian mechanics is something worthwhile doing. I'm not saying it's not, okay? It's just I'm trying to justify why I'm doing something that's a little bit different. Okay, so the idea is that what I want to look at is this idea that there's a progression of events. Things are in the future, somehow become the present, and then they become the past. And they're connected. If you look at interpretations of block universe, you might have this idea that, well, you could be at different moments and have memories that are consistent with that particular time, but there's no way to go from one moment to the next. Okay? And what I'm talking about is connected to the arrows of time. There's quite a few of these, and I haven't got an exhaustive list. They point away from the past and into the future. For example, the cosmological is away from the Big Bang and in the direction of an expanding universe, etc. They come about in two basic ways. One is that we can think about them in terms of time-symmetric theory, physical theory, but with special conditions. Okay? Or they may well have time asymmetric dynamics. So there's two ways. You have dynamics which is symmetric, but you have special conditions, or you have asymmetric, time asymmetric dynamics. Well, most of them come in the first category. The cosmological arrow has a special condition to begin with that kicks the whole thing off. And from the idea of an expanding universe, you can see that there's an abundance of retarded radiation. This gives the basis of the electromagnetic arrow. This gives an explanation of it. David Pegg wrote about that some time ago, and so on. So we have these arrows, which are all related to this idea of a special condition. But one that sticks out is the matter-antimatter arrow. It points away from a balance between matter and antimatter to the situation we have today, which is there's predominance of matter. This was discovered, this violation of charge parity invariance was discovered with neutral kaon decay in 1964. It only partially accounts for the dominance of matter over antimatter, but work is ongoing with different kinds of CP invariance violations. And there's recent work on B mesons that give a larger violation. They seem more promising. Now, what this particular arrow is associated with is time asymmetric dynamics. It's not so much about the conditions. It's really about the dynamics. And what I will look at is the relative quantum fidelities. So a quantum fidelity is just an inner product between two states. You see how similar they are. That take the square of that inner product, and you get a probability. So the things I'll be looking at is taking what would be regarded as a present state with something that's evolved backwards in time, and taking the ratio of that with the present state with evolving forwards in time with this kind of dynamics, and you get something which behaves like this, that they're not symmetric. And it's a very small number, so what this is saying that this is less than one, so it's going backwards in time is less likely than going forwards in time. But if you take, this is just for one neutral kaon decay, if you take n of them, then you have this exponential increase. Okay, so then it becomes quite important. This seems measurable. Epsilon is of the order of 10 to the minus 3. So this is, they're almost equal, like the future looks like the past. So there's no real bias, a very small bias. But if you take n particles, and there's quite a few kaons about, then you get something that's quite significant. So something that's quite insignificant, decay of kaons, seemingly can have a significant effect. So the rest of the talk is going to be about looking at the violation of time reversal invariance. Looking at the present state, how it relates to future states and past states, and then looking specifically at these experimental results. Oops. So the time reversal invariance is based on this idea of, well, there's two approaches to it. This is Wigner's approach. And the idea is that you have a system, this is just a classical system, that you have a particle, say it's the Earth, we're going around the Sun. If you want to see if the dynamics are time symmetric, well, you can't turn time back. But what you do is you let it evolve from some initial state. Well, actually, I've got states here as if they're quantum. But this applies also to classical systems. You let the system evolve for a period, and you want to see if that evolution is time symmetric. You change momentum into all the momentums into their negatives, so you inverse the momentums. And then you let it evolve for the same length of time. And if you come back, well, when you get back, it'll be, oh, this is the right diagram. So you go around into the future, you reverse the momentum, you let it evolve back. It's still evolving forwards in time, but it's reversing its track. And then you have to change momentum again. And if you end up in exactly the same state you started with, then the dynamic is the time reversal invariant. And what it means for quantum mechanics is that the Hamiltonian is invariant to that process of changing momenta, changing the sign of momenta. The CPT theorem is that if you do charge conjugation, parity inversion, and time reversal all together, that you end up with just the identity, the state of the universe doesn't change, or the state of the system doesn't change. So a lot experiments today seem to be consistent with this result. So that means that this violation of CP will be equivalent to a violation of time reversal invariance. Okay. Under CPT invariance, it means that the Hamiltonian is Hermitian, so it's quite straightforward to deal with it. Now, how do we deal with systems when we're thinking about motion in the past and in the future, especially if we've got irreversibility built in? Well, if you have a gas and it happens to be in a state of low entropy, then your predictions about the future, because you won't have information about the motions, the individual motions of the atoms, of molecules, will be of an increased entropy. And if you retrodict the past, you will also have an increase in entropy. It'll be in a more likely state. So if you're in an unlikely state to begin with, you predict both in the past and the future that it's in a more likely state. Okay, so there's a symmetry. If you don't know the direction of time, you haven't got any information about any other point in time, then that's your predictions. So this is a guide for how we're going to put in the Hamiltonian for these time asymmetric situations. So the direction of evolution here is in the direction of information loss. So if we, you know, predicting the future and retrodicting the past, it's the direction of the supposed evolution. Now for a quantum case, if you look at an open quantum system, and these seem to have an arrow of time built into them, but they don't really. This is work by Stenholm, that what you get from a system which is damped by, you know, an open system which is damped by an environment, if you reverse time, you just get damping into the past. So it's exactly the same case as predictions and recondictions of entropy of a gas, that there's information loss because of the damping and the coupling with the environment, both into the future and into the past. Okay, so there's a very straightforward formalism that Stenholm used, and that was to take the Liouvillean of the master equation and apply this time reversal operation to it, and you get these dynamics. So the thing is that the message here is that we have to treat the past and the future symmetrically. Okay? So when it comes to putting in this Hamiltonian, which is time reversal, which violates time reversal invariance, so how can we do it? Well, what we should do is that, well, actually, they're regarded as, kaons are regarded as violating CP invariance. So that the violation of CP invariance into the past should be the same as the violation into the future. Okay, so that's how we're going to put this Hamiltonian in, is this, in this symmetrical way. But it violates, in some sense, I mean, this is just a squiggle that doesn't really mean anything, but it's the same in both the forwards direction and the reverse direction. That means that the Hamiltonian we use should have should be different when we're going into the past compared to the future. Okay, so this is the way that we do it. This Hamiltonian, if H is CP non-invariant, then this operation here will undo whatever this operation does. Okay, and because of the CPT theorem, it means we can just use the time reversal of the Hamiltonian. Now you note that if the Hamiltonian was time reversal invariant, then you would just get H here, and this evolution would be, well, this has got a minus in front of it, that's the normal unitary evolution to the future, and with the plus here, you're just going to the past. So that's exactly what we'd expect. Now, just to sort of pick the state that represents the present, to do this, I'm going to look at, well, this is the canonical approach to quantum gravity, and look at the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Okay, Pegg's solution to this, with his formalism, is that the ground state of the universe, what this state represents, is a superposition of a lot of states which represent this universe at different points in time. So it represents the whole history. So it's got time built in. I mean, this doesn't mean that there's no evolution. The time is built in because it's a superposition of all these states. Now, to actually see the process going on, and this is like what Jared was talking about before and what Steve was talking about earlier, that your variables for time should be internal to the universe. There shouldn't be something external. So to actually put that in, you divide the universe up into a part that you call the clock and the rest. Now, the part you call the clock has to have certain properties, and it could be something like a rotating black hole, and that would have the right sort of properties. So each one of these states is split up into a state of the clock and a state of the rest of the universe. Okay, so it's a superposition of all these. Now, time is just some parameter of the state of the clock. So it's not external to the universe, it's actually internal. Now, what I want to look at is to break the symmetry, because this is equivalent to the block universe. All times are present. No time is special. But I know I'm here. I'm in one world of the many worlds, and I'm at one time of the many times. So I want to break it and say, well, look, I want to see what it's like to be in one of these states, just one. In the many worlds theory, you'd be saying, well, what's it like for an observer who finds him or herself in one of the states, one of the many worlds? And Schrodinger's equation will tell you what that's like. So I want to do the same here. Okay, so I'm going to pick one of those states. Now, the resolution, we have a limited ability to resolve time. So any state, or whatever information we gather about our present state, is going to, well, we can't get it at a specific time. There's got to be some spread in time. So in fact, whatever that state happens to be, what I expect it to be is to have some spread over time with respect to the clock. So it's a superposition of these states. Okay, it'll be a superposition of them. That'll be the best that I can do. Okay, so it's a superposition of different states over time. Now, so this is my present state, this is what I regard as now, and I just, using the Hamiltonian, work out what my future state would be and what a previous state would be. So knowing what we have to do is take the Hamiltonian in just the regular way, apply it to the state that I regard as now, and that'll be the state in the future. But for the, to, you know, work out what the state was in the past, I have to use this transformed Hamiltonian, okay, to keep the CP invariance equivalent in both directions. And what that means is that you end up with, obviously you're going to have different states, but the overlaps are different. Now, if this was a time reversal invariant state, Hamiltonian, I should say, like the normal Hamiltonians we use, then these overlaps between the present, the state now, and the state in the past, and the state now and the state in the future, those overlaps would be equivalent. But because it's not time reversal invariant, these overlaps can be different. Okay, it's just that, it comes down to exactly that. So if you're in a universe where there's no time asymmetry in the Hamiltonian, then this method will just say, I'm equally likely to be in the future and in the past. But there's a bias, okay? With the CP invariance violation, there's a bias between the future and the past. Now, looking at these overlaps, so it's just the inner product of these two states, and then we square it, and it's the probability of being in the future state. Now, what do I mean by this? Is that this is the state which I regard as now, and I'm not exactly sure which time it is, because I can't resolve time to such a high precision that I'd need for the universe. So it means that I'm spread, well, the rest of the universe is spread out in time, okay, a little bit forwards, a little bit back to some central point. The fact that this, there's an overlap, a non-zero overlap, means that I could well be one step into the future, okay? And likewise, if you look at this overlap with the prior state, you have exactly the same argument. There is some chance that I'm actually in the previous state, because I can't work out the time exactly. Okay, but it's more likely that we're in a future state than the past state. And I'll show that that's actually what experiments give us. Now, what does this mean? So now it gets the really controversial part. So we have these different overlaps for the future and the past. Now I'm taking a very local picture of this, very local and with respect to how I see the universe in the present time. I'm more likely to be in a future state than in a past state. These overlap, or these fidelities, A's turns out to be bigger than B. Now when I get, if I'm actually in this state, well, that'll be my present. Whatever state I'm in is my present state. Okay, it doesn't matter when it is. If I find myself in a state, that has to be the state of the present. So if I'm in this state, it's the present. In order to work out the future and past of that state, I have to apply the Hamiltonian in the way I did before. With the future evolution is with the normal Hamiltonian, normal version, and the past evolution is with the transformed one. Okay, so I end up with a different prediction about the future and the past. And so again, I have an overlap with the next future state and with this prior state, and I have a bigger overlap with the future state. It means that I don't necessarily go back because of this logic that if I use the Hamiltonians in that way, that as I move along, I have to use them relative to that local state. Okay, so it's a bit like a ratchet, but this overlap is bigger with the future state, but to work out the transit, so this is like a transition going from the present to a future state. There's a transition which is bigger than the transition into the past. But normally when you do these things, like expanding a state into a particular basis, that the transition to go backwards is exactly the same, but it's not here, okay? So once you get to this state, you have a different past than what you thought you had here, okay? So you don't get the same thing. So you end up with this ratchet effect. Now, it's not really about, taking a state and writing it in terms of a basis. This isn't really about a basis. I'm just trying to answer the question about, what is my state? And I have an overlap with the future state, a greater overlap than with the past state. That's all I'm saying. So I'm not really trying to you know, expand this state in terms of a whole basis. Okay, so now looking at the experimental work on these situations that violate CP and variance. So the K-mesons, kaons, about half the mass of a proton, under the weak interaction, they're constantly cycling between the particle and the antiparticle. They also decay to some other states, like these pions, and there's a lepton process as well. What the 1964 paper, the one that that Cronin and Finch got the Nobel Prize for, is they looked at this decay channel here. Okay, so just looked at one particular decay channel. And when you've got an oscillation between two states like this with decay, it's better to use a different basis. And the basis is in terms of long-lived particles, or a long-lived state, and a short-lived state. And these are the real particles. So kaons, there is technically a kaon and an anti-kaon, but it turns out that in terms of practical things about their lifetime, definite lifetimes, there's a long-lived kaon and a short-lived kaon. There's a difference of about 600 between their lifetimes. So if you produce a kaon in some reaction, the short-lived kaon, the component, will decay away quickly. So what you end up with is mostly these long-lived kaons. So then it's a simple matter to look at these long-lived kaons and apply the formalism. So to look at a future state, we use, well, there's a unitary model by Data and others. That so you evolve into the future, and then you look at this reversed Hamiltonian, and then compare the probabilities between making a transition from now into the future and from now into the past. And this is what I quoted at the beginning. So what it looks like is that here is now, we make there's a greater propensity or probability for finding ourselves in a future state than what we thought. And once we get there, there's another, you know, greater propensity to find ourselves in the next future state. So there seems to be something which is taking us along. And in more recent times, the B mesons have been shown to violate CP invariance. And they do this in a larger degree. This is the decay. It's a particular decay channel between the neutral B mesons and the anti B meson. There's different decay rates. And they can also do this in a reverse manner and get the things that look like they're actually traveling back in time. I won't go into that. I don't think I have enough time. But there's a big difference between these two. And so, just to sum up, the direction of time is ambiguous on its own, but if we're going to put in one of these time asymmetries, because we don't know the direction of time, if we put in one Hamiltonian only, so if I just use the H for everything, both past and future, I'd be putting in a particular, I'd be making a choice, okay, and I don't want to make that choice. So at every moment in time, I should be looking at the future with one version of the Hamiltonian and the past with another. Or it might be the other way around. You could swap these two Hamiltonians. So I don't want to put in that bias. But when you do that, then you end up with this ratchet effect. Okay, the future looks different to the past. We actually look closer to the future. And then if you look in this in a sequence of steps, it looks like that we're continually evolving into the future, transiting from one state to the next. So thank you.
Our system, our brain, our
Well, that's a good point, but it's, as I've just pointed out, that if you pick a particular state, I mean, this is, we seem to be at a particular time, a particular moment in the history of the universe, so you have to pick out a particular state to represent that. And I don't see there being any choice, that this has to be spread out over time. If you've got an internal clock that's really precise, I think for the universe we should have a clock that's really precise, far more precise than what we can actually measure ourselves. So our, I mean, as I said before, that we just have anything that you describe the our part of the universe by, any state, will be spread out both, it will have aspects that are into the future, into the past, according to this clock. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I don't think it requires that a particular brain in order to do that. It's just the fact that you pick out a particular state. That's right. And then you find that you just follow through this evolution of these picking up these extra bits of the Hamiltonian, but if you do anything, then memories will build up, and there will be a consistent build-up of memories in one direction. Of course, you can always construct a Hamiltonian to make memories are no more than correlations, and you can construct an interaction Hamiltonian to build up correlations in two directions. So you can build up correlations, in this normal way of quantum mechanics. You can have correlations which build up in the forward direction of time, and then you can also erase memories, and that look like correlations that are going away. So, but here, there's only one choice, and if you do anything at all, then they will be built up in one direction. So it doesn't really require humans, the evolution of humans. I don't think the many worlds actually requires that either. Because in the many worlds, the reason that we feel like we're in a single world is because that there are correlations, and everything that you do, you always find consistent correlations. Oh, okay. I don't think it does in this particular case, so it might be true in other cases. Flow of time. Yeah. Well, the thing about the arrows of time is that the CP violation arrow, the matter-antimatter, is not connected, doesn't seem to be connected with the others. I mean, you have the thermodynamic arrow, the psychological arrow, they seem to be linked. The cosmological arrow with, you know, low entropy state at the beginning seems to account for the thermodynamical arrow. They seem to be all linked. But the matter-antimatter arrow, while it sort of seems to point, well, it does point away from a balance between matter and antimatter, it doesn't seem to fit in. It doesn't seem to have any effect on us. All the others seem to have an effect, a macroscopic effect, but the matter-antimatter doesn't, that's what no one has ever talked about, a way in which it affects our sense of time. And what I'm showing here is that just from the quantum superpositions, or quantum overlaps, I should say, that it has this asymmetry comes out in a big way. So I'm just trying to point that out. So I'm not really trying to use a particular arrow, it's just the asymmetry, which is the dynamics, the asymmetry and the dynamics is the Hamiltonian, which is not time symmetric, and using that to in a completely different way to what people do when you talk about arrows of time, well, the other arrows of time. So I don't know if that answers what you're... It's, well, I guess I might be different, but I feel that I'm in one moment of time, and if I describe that, I'd be using a quantum state to describe the universe with a particular time associated with it, a moment later. Well, in fact, when I just described it, that's now in the past. So that's what I'm trying to describe, the fact that... I mean, this doesn't really describe that feeling at all, except that when you when this Hamiltonian is performing correlations and interactions between systems, then it will be doing this in a particular direction. So, if I construct it to, you know, if I go out and have a look at something, then this will be consistent with one direction of time, whatever those interactions are. Well, we just have the blocked universe. Yeah. Well, it just, in as much as what the blocked universe explains our motion through time, then you're left with that. So whenever this isn't working, this mechanism is not working, if there are sentient beings there, they would have whatever the description is supplied by the blocked universe. So if you're happy with the blocked universe, then that's okay, right? But it's not something I'm happy with. Yeah.